You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for 220K.
T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Control room, you're on the air.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek, and today we're speaking to author-researcher Mr. John Washburn, who's written several times for Kennedys and King, but he has a new article up just this Wednesday, October 1st, The Wrong Bus Transfer, Part 1. This is about the Oswald bus lines, and there's a Part 2 up as well. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me again, Len.
Yeah, as I was mentioning several times, I'm always interested and happy to have people who are doing good research on the Kennedy assassination and even other topics. But just in the fact that there's seems to be disinformation or people that are muddy the waters, anybody who's doing any kind of good work, you caught the eye of Jim DiEugenio, so your stuff is on Kennedys and King, so that's a feather in your cap right there. So today, I'd like to give you the floor to discuss this article, your most recent article, which is just up. I guess give us an overview and we'll get into it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I started this by looking at the stuff that Roger Craig was saying in the afternoon immediately after the assassination on the 22nd. And I then got slightly diverted by looking at the original documents of the bus transfer that was supposedly found on Oswald late afternoon on the 22nd, and comparing that to what was actually the number in the line of the bus. And if you go to my second article, and it's right at the front, you can see juxtaposed next to it, you've got this frontage of the bus saying Line 30 Marseilles Union Station, and then you've got a bus transfer which is punched with a bat shape mark against Lakewood Line 23. So that instantly looked mysterious to me, because if you look below the Lakewood stamp, you can see you've got capital West Shore, and then you've got 30 Marseilles. So the bus driver did not punch the transfer for the route that Oswald was supposed to have been on, which was the number 30 Marseilles bus. To describe the geography of Dallas a little bit, there's a big river called the Trinity River, very often dry, which runs northwest to southeast. Downtown is north of the Trinity River. Marseilles, which is Oak Cliff, is south of the Trinity River. You need to go over the Houston Street Viaduct to get there. That bus started its journey that day in the Lakewood District in the north of Dallas. So this bus basically goes from the north to the south of Dallas, crossing the Trinity River at the Houston Street Viaduct, having gone downtown. That is Route 30. You can see that in the bus maps I've linked to. You can see that in the Gerald Ford Presidential Library, because he kept some of the paperwork for himself. Lakewood, which is Line 23, is North Dallas. It's where the 30 bus started, but it's also where the 23 bus started. But the 23 bus never went over the river. It just went to downtown and back. I presume it went to Union Station and back. So that was a shorter route. Now, immediately, without having to look into the detail of how bus transfers might work, a bus transfer on or from Route 23 would have been no use to anybody heading to Oak Cliff over the other side of the river. So you just rule out Lakewood as having any relevance whatsoever. Whereas Marcela's bus is a bus that crosses the river, which is the one Oswald was supposed to be on. So there's a clear discrepancy there. And I therefore looked more carefully at the bus driver, Cecil McWhorter's testimony and his account of movements. And you can see the poor guy got pulled off a bus at 6:15 that evening, 22nd of November, was pulled in and immediately was asked to identify Oswald in an identity parade. And after that, he was then showed a bus transfer, which he said was one that he'd issued because I think he recognised his bat-shaped punch mark because each driver had a different punch mark. So he was looking at it. Interestingly, he told one of his passengers, who I'll get onto later, a young guy, teenager called Roy Middleton Jones. He told Roy Middleton Jones next time he saw him on the same bus that he'd been held at the police station for 7 hours until 1 p.m. in the morning. I mean, that's a long time to discuss a bus transfer following a identity parade. So clearly something very, very wrong with the testimony of Waters so far as the bus transfer is concerned.
The whole thing seemed fishy to me because, it's like they had something fluid in motion. They had a scenario to set up and they were trying to make it work. If Oswald's here or there or walking or in a car or took a cab or didn't take a cab or took a bus, they had to, on the fly, make the thing work.
Yeah, they did. And what again is interesting, which I refer to in my article, Roger Craig, Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig, said, and he prepared an affidavit at about 5:15 that afternoon of the assassination, that he saw Oswald getting into a Rambler after a man whistled at him. He ran down the slope to Elm Street and got into the Nash Rambler, which headed underneath the underpass towards Oak Cliff, in which case it would have gone down Beckley. Because Oswald didn't die at the Texas Theatre, he was obviously alive sitting in Captain Fritz's office. Roger Craig came in and saw Oswald and recognised him as the person he'd seen earlier getting into the Rambler. And he didn't ever budge his story from that point, much to his disadvantage. It ruined his career and he ended up dying. The official story was he committed suicide. I think that's up for grabs as to whether that's true or not. But what is particularly interesting is Fritz's testimony to the Warren Commission said that he ignored what Roger Craig was telling him because he knew it was not true. How Craig could know it wasn't true at 5:15 in the afternoon is a complete mystery unless he's making it up. Fritz said that Oswald originally told him that he'd got the bus to his boarding house in Beckley, which actually isn't the Marcellus bus because the Marcellus bus doesn't go there. Fritz then said that that afternoon, Oswald changed his story to say that he'd got out of the bus and got a cab. Well, that's completely false because the cab story didn't emerge until the next day. So the key thing there is that there was nothing that Fritz actually had to go on. Fritz was the head of the Homicide Bureau at Dallas Police Force to counter what Craig was saying. So this line, I call Fritz's Freudian slip, how can he not have known it was true? All points in the direction of a stitch up. If you read further into Waters's movements, he makes clear that after he'd done the Marcellus run, which basically was going from Lakewood to South Marcellus over the river and then back, he changed bus. And what I postulate in my article is that after Oswald was arrested, they somehow needed to create this story, as you say, of him getting on a bus. Knew that McWhorter's bus was of interest, which I'll touch on in a minute. Told somebody to go and get a bus transfer off of McWhorter's bus, not realizing he changed routes and he was actually on the Lakewood route. And I mean, it's pretty easy to get a bus transfer. All you need to do is get on a bus and then get off and ask for a transfer. So anybody close to the police force could have done that. But clearly there seems to be this mistake in assuming that McWhorter had carried on driving the Line 30 Marcellus bus when he changed to Lakewood. You can deduce that in another way as well. McWhorter was adamant that after he started his trip, and the Marcellus trip was his first run of the day, he started it about midday. So he would have been downtown, supposedly picking up Oswald at about 22, 12:45. He said he only issued two bus transfers. Well, that bus transfer has a serial number on it, and the serial number of the first transfer of that book is now available on the web. It appeared in an FBI file from the foreman at the bus depot. It's quite clear that on the account of McWhorter's only issuing two transfers downtown, the first transfer in his book was the one that signed as a receipt. Therefore, Oswald should have had the first or second transfer by serial number, but it's the eighth. And that therefore points again in the direction that that transfer was issued much later in the day after McWhorter's had done his Marcellus journey and switched routes to the Lakewood line. And the book of transfers is personal to the driver. So even if the driver changes bus and changes route, they carry their punch with them and they carry their allocation of transfers for the day. Transfers are obviously valuable instruments because they avoid a person having to buy another full bus ticket. So the evidence points towards at some point in the afternoon after Oswald was arrested, somebody goes out to find a bus transfer for McWhorter's Marcellus bus and messes up and gets the wrong one. The problem they've got is that that is entered into evidence by then, and it's too late to change it. McWhorter's has already been in the lineup at about 6:15, 6:30 that afternoon. And from then onwards, they've got a problem. They've got a story that is barely hanging together of Oswald getting a bus and then a cab, with the cab bit not appearing to the next day. But they clearly know that they've got a problem with the bus transfer saying the wrong thing. Interestingly, the photograph I've got of the Marcellus bus isn't the one that actually appears in the commission evidence, because you can't read Union Station on that. That looks like a blank piece of canvas. So I think there was some sensitivity as to what was actually going to be written on the front of the bus, because McWhorter's story to try to justify when Ball asks him, why have you got a transfer marked to Lakewood? He tries to pretend that if he had Lakewood on the front of the bus as the signage, he would stamp it Lakewood. Well, whichever way you look at it, a bus heading in the direction of Marcellus isn't the bus heading in the direction of Lakewood in the opposite direction. So there'd be no legitimate reason why anybody on a Marcellus bus would ever punch what has been punched, line 23, Lakewood. So yeah, there is clearly a major problem with that bus transfer, which throws up into the air the whole story about Oswald getting on a bus, which I think was unlikely anyhow. Certainly, I think the taxi element could be dismissed for reasons I wrote in one of my other articles. So
Yeah, and we should
there's some.
mention just to people that in your article, there's hyperlinks to all these routes and photos and exhibits that if you go to Kennedy's and King, I'll make a link to it, but you can see all these things that we're talking about right now.
Yeah, exactly. And on the taxi issue, the schedule shows that the driver actually picks somebody up from the Greyhound bus station at 12:30, and they therefore had a major problem because by the commission timeline, he needed to be picked up just after qu quarter to one. So there's a almost 20-minute discrepancy there, and the description of the person wasn't particularly good either. So the taxi bit of the story again seems to be more improvisation. What is interesting though is, well, if you were trying to fix up Oswald for being on a bus, was it that important that it was the Marcellus bus? I think it was. I don't think Oswald was on it, but I think somebody was on it. And there are several clues as to something odd going on that bus. First of all, I'll talk about the identification evidence. The police representations to the Warren Commission were that McWhorter's had identified Oswald in that identity parade. If you read what was going on, the best McWhorter's came up with was that Oswald was a person who looked most like somebody who'd been on his bus, which isn't a clear identification at all. It's just saying somebody looks more like somebody than the other people. And I showed photographs of that in my article as well. And to use those people as fillers in a lineup is particularly ridiculous if you actually look at the photographs of those people and compare them to Oswald. But what then happened in the commission session itself in Washington? But Waters completely withdraws his identification of Oswald and says that the person he saw was the young chap I mentioned earlier, Roy Middleton Jones, who he said he picked up in downtown and dropped off right at the end of the route, south of the river at Brownlow in on South Marcellus Avenue. And that causes a clear problem, and therefore the FBI are asked by the commission to interview Milton Jones. That appears in the evidence. Milton Jones's evidence is absolutely fascinating. Milton Jones seems to have better recollection than Waters, although the two had talked together after the assassination, as Milton Jones's FBI statement says. Milton Jones says that the bus was held up downtown for almost an hour because the police boarded it. That doesn't appear in any of McWaters' affidavits, FBI statements, or his testimony. But interestingly, I did find in the Dallas Morning News the week after the assassination that Waters did actually give the game away because he said that having left downtown, having been delayed, he arrived at the junction of Jefferson Avenue and South and Marcellus, that would have been North Marcellus there, only to come across the hullabaloo outside the library on Jefferson, where there was a false alarm that Oswald had been seen entering the library. You can pin that time to 12:30 from Dallas Police Radio. I don't think there's very much dispute about that. Maybe a few minutes out either way because of the problems I've discussed with the timing on the radio. But basically, McWaters was running about 40 to 50 minutes late, which corresponds to what Milton Jones says. So there's clearly something about that bus being stopped that was taboo enough for somebody to persuade McWaters never to raise it after he'd mentioned it in the Dallas Morning News. And you end up actually having this absurd situation where, because McWaters said the man who got off the bus, who he'd identified as Oswald, got off at the bus at the end of the line, which would be another 20 minutes later, McWaters actually had been giving the rest at the Texas Theatre. So the whole story is quite clearly ridiculous. And I don't think there's any doubt that it was Milton Jones who got off at the south end of Marcellus, who was the person that McWaters said he'd seen on his bus. What's also particularly interesting about why McWaters could be so clear on the identification of Milton Jones as opposed to Oswald is this quirk of the Dallas bus system. As I said, a river ran through the middle of Dallas, northwest to southeast, and the bus routes were, but the bus fares were split into zones. Zone one was downtown and stretched out for about 3 to 4 miles, and then you had zone two. The protocol for getting on and off a bus was quite interesting. If you got a bus from zone two in Dallas to downtown, you paid the full fare for zone two to downtown. That meant that you could then leave the bus at any time using the rear door only. So you'd create a flow of passengers arriving to pay, coming through the front door, but anybody could then get off through the back door. That wasn't reflected if you caught the bus downtown. If you caught the bus downtown, everybody paid the zone one fare irrespective of where they were going. And they paid the difference when they got off. So if they moved into zone two, they would pay an additional top-up fare for having got off in zone two. And that forced them to use the front door to get off. And I checked, and where Milton Jones got off at Brownlow and Marcellus is about a mile into zone two. So Milton Jones would actually have had to encounter the driver to get off the bus at that time and pay the additional fare. So the driver would identify passengers, one who'd got on the bus to pay first time round, two, any passengers wanting to get a bus transfer to another route, or if you travelled as far as zone two, any passenger getting off would have to encounter him again to pay to top up your fare to a zone two fare, which is quite interesting. Which explains why McWaters should be so clear as to the fact it was really Milton Jones he saw on the bus and where Milton Jones got off. And I've checked the city directories and things, and Milton Jones's family did live on Brownlow, about a block from Marcellus. So yeah, we have this bizarre situation where the commission presented a bus driver to the commission itself in Washington. So you had Gerald Ford and others there with a completely false story of a false of identification of Oswald. I mean, if anything, McWaters proves that Oswald wasn't on his bus, but the story needed to be made up that he was.
Yeah, it's you've gone into the nth degree here, how this just can't happen the way the Warren Commission claimed it happened.
Well, you have what I call evidence that doesn't fit the story. You have evidence that's being suppressed. You have evidence that's directly contrary. But you then have the behavior of people who, in the face of that, still try to maintain the original story. And if there'd ever been a court hearing with a proper adversarial system of somebody cross-examining the people presenting the case, this story would just fall flat on its face. Mark Lane obviously tried to do that for the Warren Commission, but wasn't allowed to do it in a formal way. There was no cross-examination of the witnesses. As I say, this story of Oswald being on the Marcellus bus is just fiction, which pushes the pendulum of believing evidence back towards Roger Craig's version of somebody who he said was Oswald getting into a Rambler. And I think the best evidence that Craig is right is actually the effort that went into proving him wrong. If Craig was wrong, you wouldn't need to go to all these lengths to make him appear to be wrong, because you'd have a credible story as to how Oswald had actually left downtown and gone to the Texas Theatre. And of course, Craig's story fits with Butch Burrows, the concession manager at the Texas Theatre, who said that Oswald had arrived just after 1 p.m. and bought popcorn at 1:15, which ruled him out of having been to his rooming house at 1 o'clock, and also rules him out of murdering Officer Tippett.
It's just amazing the amount of details that you've pulled out here from the most minuscule of items here, but it just never fails to amaze me that the way the Warren Commission bends and twists and tries to make something happen where it just didn't.
I thought that Joe Ball was one of the better Warren Commission questioners. Another one who was good was Bert Griffin. The worst was David Bellin, who tried to put words into people's mouths and deliberately interrupted if somebody was going to say something inconvenient, so he changed the subject. I mean, in the case of the rooming house owner, the argument required Oswald being in that small room because the guest house was full up. There was only 17 rooms. And it transpired that it had not been fully booked all that year, which begs the question how it could be full enough for Oswald to have to sleep in the small room. And when I've forgotten the name of the guest house owner now, it'll come to me in a sec. Anyway, when the guest house owner says how many rooms there are, Bellin asks him how many years he'd been married, which is just total non-sequitur.
Bellin, he the fix was in with him.
Yeah, the name
Oh.
of the person I've forgotten was Arthur Johnson, and his wife was Gladys Johnson. But now, back to Ball. Having read carefully now the testimony of McWaters, Ball must have been in on the fiction, because a 12-year-old could see that there was a discrepancy between McWaters' story and the Warren Commission line and what the bus transfer actually says, as well as the basic geography of bus routes. But as I say, I think the bus was of significance, and the evidence for that is the fact that the police boarded it. So tying in with my other work, I think there was a decoy on the bus. I've concluded in other articles it was Larry Crayford. I concluded that he'd got on the bus at Murphy Street, because that was the nearest stop to the Carousel Club, where he was supposedly staying. And he was meant to cross the Trinity River and be met by Tippett at Glocco Services, but Tippett turned mid-operation and had to be eliminated, and Crayfard had to be taken on the off the bus. And that 40-minute, 50-minute delay by the police is a kind of cover to explain to other passengers without them realizing one particular passenger had been taken off the bus, which I think was Crayfard. That's what I think is going on. What is interestingly is only Milton Jones describes it as the police boarding the bus. The closest McWaters came to in his testimony of describing an interaction is he said a man pulled up in a car next to the bus, banged on the door, and told him that the president had been shot. That was a guy driving a car, so it wasn't Oswald. But of course, if that was a policeman who didn't wear a uniform, that fits with Milton Jones saying the police boarded. And I think the person who knocked on the bus door was possibly Captain Westbrook, who had to change his plans to basically get Crayfard off the bus and then move Crayfard into Oak Cliff to effectively help frame Oswald for what was going to be the elimination of Tippett. I think Officer Tippett was basically the first of what I call a clean-up murder. I think the assassination was sufficiently planned that they would know things would go wrong, and you had to have clean-ups if somebody got in the way. And I think Tippett was the first victim of a clean-up operation. In fact, I think clean-up operations carried on for several years, including Dorothy Kilgallen.
And Lee Bowers.
Oh, certainly Lee Bowers, possibly Roger Craig himself. I mean, the number of people who supposedly committed suicide by shooting themselves is extraordinary. Motor accidents, crashing into motorway, freeway bridges.
Yeah, single car accidents.
Yeah, single car accidents. I mean, William Whaley died in a car accident, the cab driver, whose daughter said that he didn't have Oswald in his car. She said it was very clear he'd been coerced into saying it. Because the interesting thing is about as soon as you knock out the bus journey, you've destroyed the commission's case completely, because you haven't explained how Oswald has got to the Texas Theatre without anything other than Roger Craig's story. And that opens it up to a conspiracy and fits then with a line that Oswald was a patsy being set up.
Yeah, in retrospect, thank goodness we have that hallway interview where they're asking, "Did you kill him? Did you kill him?" And he goes, "No, I'm just a patsy." And right then you kind of go, "Oh, let's look into that angle, you know."
Well, that I've always found that particularly interesting, because he's not saying he's innocent. He said that he hasn't shot Tippett or the president, which I believe. I don't think he fired any weapon that day. But saying that he's a patsy suggests he knew something was going to happen. I mean, you can't explain his behavior, why anybody else would jump into a Nash Rambler outside the depository building because somebody's whistled at them. I mean, Oswald was clearly up to something, and he was up to something by his behavior in the Texas Theatre, because he was reported as moving around the theatre, sitting next to different people, as if he was
Trying to meet a contact.
planning to rendezvous with everybody. Yet, and he had a dollar bill that was torn in half, which is again spycraft for finding the person who's got the other half to match it, etc., etc. So something was clearly going on. But by the time Oswald is caught by the camera and the microphone and the police station, he's realised he's a patsy. Whether he knew that Kennedy was going to be shot or not, I don't know. Whether he thought there was going to be a kind of false flag disturbance around Kennedy where he wouldn't be shot, but it would look like an assassination attempt to provoke Kennedy to take a harder line on Cuba. Who knows? But I think it's absolutely certain. I think now that Oswald went from the depository to the Texas Theatre in the way that Roger Craig described. My only question is whether he went anywhere else between that time and the just after 1 p.m. when he arrived at the Texas Theatre. It would have only taken him 5 to 10 minutes at the most to be driven to the Texas Theatre. So you've got 10 or so minutes unaccounted for. I haven't, on Black Ops, gone through my conclusion that Oswald didn't sleep in that small room at the Beckley boarding house. I think Oswald stayed in a normal room. and the small room was created as a cover the afternoon of the assassination, because Tippit's murder threw a whole load of things out of sequence, including evidence planting at 1026 North Beckley. And that article I wrote explains how the Johnsons and Earlene Roberts at the guest house are dropping out clues that the police arrived there very soon after Tippett was shot, so very soon after 1:30, whereas the official story was that they didn't arrive until after 3, and they were supposedly waiting then for a judge to give them a warrant to search the rooms. I don't believe that the Dallas police force would have waited for a warrant to search the rooms at 102 North Beckley. The law in the US is pretty clear. If somebody's in hot pursuit, you don't need a warrant. If somebody's under arrest, then you do need a warrant to search their property. By 3 o'clock, obviously, Oswald was under arrest. But I think due to the murder of Tippett, somebody found the wallet, which had the Beckley address in it, and they ran and searched Oswald's actual room at 102 North Beckley and didn't find anything because the evidence hadn't yet been planted. And those officers, therefore, would be suspicious if evidence then suddenly appeared in the room that they'd searched. As I say, not all officers were bent. And the best they could come up with was that they had to persuade everybody that Oswald had actually stayed in that small room. So my one outstanding question in this area now is, did Oswald actually go back to Beckley himself earlier than 1 o'clock, but just managed to go to the annex at the back, which had about six rooms, and therefore Earlene Roberts, the housekeeper, wouldn't see him coming and going because it was separate to the main house. So that gets into whether Oswald changed his clothes or not. I'm open-minded on that.
Okay, well, you have part one and part two up. And this is recent, just the first Wednesday, October 1st, is up at Kennedy's and King. So that's this week. And I urge people to go and read your article and look at the evidence that you have. A lot of hyperlinks where you can find everything that we've been talking about here. I'm not sure, have you covered everything you wanted to cover?
Yeah, if I could just chat about some of the
Oh, very, very good. Go ahead.
stuff on the education forum, because I said after I'd written this article, I noticed that somebody called Steve Farley about 10 years ago was on the right track regarding this. Obviously, I don't think Steve by then had understood in the way I had that the radio tapes had been tampered with, which is how I got into this whole thing. But in trying to support the Warren Commission line, certain researchers have come up with remarkable suggestions that Oswald was really trying to get the Marcellus bus because he wanted to transfer at Lancaster Avenue to get a bus to Lancaster to then get a long distance coach to Laredo in Mexico. It just doesn't stack up at all. In fact, that scenario completely runs against the Tippett timeline. It also runs against the time on the bus transfer. And something I haven't said that is in my article, if you look at the design of a bus transfer, it has 12 hours marked on it. Each hour then has some 15-minute intervals. And to validate the ticket for a short time window, which is basically 15 minutes after the next closest 15 minutes, which means if you got off a bus at 22, 12, the next 15 minutes after 12:45 would be one, so it'd be punched from one. Anybody getting on a bus after one or two or three couldn't get on another bus later than the 15-minute allowance because that bit had been chopped off. But anybody getting a bus transfer that was, say, marked for 4 p.m. could easily recreate it for 1 p.m. by just cutting it underneath the 1 p.m. mark. You can always make a bus transfer appear earlier. You can't make it appear later. And that appears relevant in this case. So yes, I missed earlier that what I think happened was the bus transfer was probably issued sometime after 3 p.m., would have been cut for 3 o'clock, 3:15, 3:45, whatever. But it'd be very easy for somebody tampering with evidence just to chop it into a stub, as I've shown, at 1 p.m. And of course, that 1 p.m. doesn't actually fit with the commission timeline either, because Oswald was supposed to have got off the bus at 20 to 1, in which case it would have been stamped for 12:45, which would have then been valid for 15 minutes until 1 o'clock. So it wouldn't have been punched for 1 p.m. It would have been punched for 12:45.
Yeah, it's amazing to see that people are still trying to make the Warren Commission fit, that they're still out there arguing on these forums about how Lee Oswald did it after all, and the Warren Commission had it right. And you just wonder, how do they have time in the day to keep going over that?
Well, I try to sort the wheat from the chaff in those cases to work out, are they stupid? Are they gullible? I certainly wouldn't want them to be on a jury where there needs to be any kind of challenging of evidence. Or are they part of an ongoing project to create perpetual disinformation?
Exactly. Really. And the worst conclusion is they're on some kind of USAID payroll, that they're out there just to keep the waters murky, that anybody looking into it won't be able to have a good handle on what happened, and just keep stirring up the shit.
Yeah, absolutely. As I say, you just need to browse around YouTube to look at any copy of the Zapruder film to see there are people still out there suggesting that it suggests a shot from the back, which is just not credible. And also suggesting that Governor Connolly was shot at the same time that Kennedy had already received the neck wound, when it's quite clear that Connolly himself said he wasn't shot by the same bullet as Kennedy. And Connolly's reaction, i.e., pain on his face, is several seconds after Kennedy has already brought his hands up to his neck. Just you'd assume that Kennedy and Connolly and Mrs. Connolly had a better grasp of what was going on than somebody looking at YouTube and misunderstanding what it shows.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anything else then before we wrap up? Is there anything else you wanted to get to that I give you time to right now?
I think that's fine, Len. Yeah, obviously, anything else that you want to, because if I rambled on a little bit too
Oh,
much, and
no, I don't bother with
I'm
that.
not
I mean,
precious. I'm not, I'm actually, I'm never precious about my own work, because I always want the right answer rather than being prissy prissy about things. But interestingly, you raised John McAdams. I early on when I started doing this got John McAdams mixed up with Joan McBride. And obviously, you couldn't have two more opposite people. And when I realized that they were two different people, I think it was both called Mac, I just came to the conclusion that anything that Adams put out was just completely unreliable. And his website in particular is appalling, because it's quite clearly got clipped information that misses out pieces of vital evidence to help his case.
well, it's a complete fraud. He was a complete fraud as a person, and so
Yeah.
they paid him well, and he just parroted whatever the, he was funded for sure. He had a radio show that had CIA recruitment advertising on it. Yeah, he went to some seminar, disguised himself. He said, "Well, false impersonation." He said he was a jet propulsion expert named Paul Nolan, but
Well,
then some report.
British intelligence recruited people at Cambridge by finding the smartest people and tapping them on the shoulder. I would have thought that if the CIA was using McAdams, they'd end up finding the most stupid people in America, but that's
Well, you know what? There's an art to this where if you're getting enough money, you'll just say anything. And to the uninitiated, they think, oh, this guy's onto something. So if he's getting a cushy check, then he doesn't care what people think of him. I mean, I had a website on him where I collected all the stuff. It was called John McAdams, the laughing stock of the internet. And he and his supporters were quite mad that when I had some Wikipedia battles on Fletcher Prouty, that people started putting disinformation up on them and they wouldn't take it down. And so it came to the point where they said, if you take down the McAdams page, we will take this down. It's unbelievable. I had about a 4-year battle with these moderators or admins at Wikipedia. A good thing I archived it all, because it was just ridiculous. And now that the lately on, I think Tucker Carlson, he had on one of the originators, the first invented, put out Wikipedia. It's not what they thought it was going to be, and they realized that it had been taken over by intelligence agencies, and people are paid there, and these admins are paid to do that, to remove stuff. Like, I mean, I was blacklisted. Every time I would correct something, I was charged with vandalism on the site, and they would not let Prouty.org, which is the main website of Fletcher Prouty, be linked there. Because I had that page in there. I had the page McAdams, John McAdams, the laughing stock of the internet, and all the different people that had their little battles with him. Like Lisa Peace said, you know, she would go in there, she would correct him, he would realize he was wrong, and then a month later on some other forum, she'd see that he was putting the same shit up, you know, and said, you know this is wrong. I've already corrected you. I've told you the story. But so then, you know, he's on a payroll somehow. And there's people out there today, like on the education forum and things like that. You go, they can't be that stupid, can they? So yeah. A few times I'll just write that. I'll say, oh, this is a troll bot. This is a bot because nobody is that stupid. And it forces them to either reply. But other example I would say is that there's an example of somebody who's, I think, disinformation, which was Gary Mack. Gary Mack clearly changed his tune when he got a job working for the school book depository there, the museum, right?
Oh, yeah, but that was funny because I've seen a video where he did a TV show where they lined up laser beams showing that if somebody had fired the headshot at Kennedy from the Grassy Knoll area, that it would have hit one of three men standing on the staircase going up to the pergola area. I spotted some smart person, and I spotted that to do that, he had to move where those people were located, and he did it by making the whole thing look dark because he made it look like they had their feet by the curbside, whereas in fact they were way up the slope on a landing brake in the staircase going down. I mean, it was just absolutely laughable. Once you knew the problem was there, you could see it. So he was clearly going along with that, and I guess he was paid off for money. But the whole sixth floor museum is really like a freak show. And what I find fascinating is how many people implicated in it, who I think are implicated in the assassination, are prepared to go along there to kind of carry on justifying their story. I mean, Ruth Payne was a good example. He almost couldn't shut her up if there was an opportunity for her to carry on pushing her line.
Yeah.
The other one is Larry Sabato.
Yeah.
If you come across him.
Yeah, I think he was one of the very first speakers at the 2013 Searle Wecht convention in Pittsburgh. And I was just sitting there in my chair shaking my head going, who the hell is this guy? Are you kidding me?
What this is actually relevant to how I got into all of this, because the first piece of work I did for K&K was the Dallas police tapes. And it was only because I'd found on YouTube, on actually Larry Sabato's site, the hour-long extract of the radio from 20 past 12 to 20 past 1. And anybody could pick it up on YouTube. And I had a feeling that there's something wrong with the radio transcript. So I actually sat down one day and played the transcript off the radio and then reading it against the Warren Commission. And that's how I picked up that there was systemic missing of calls and mistranscription. And it was when I got to Tippett at about 10 to 1, 5 to 1, saying the transcript says he said he was at Lancaster and 8th. But by listening to the tape, he actually says Lansing and 8th. It's very clear. He says it with that kind of Texas drawl. And obviously the consonants of Lancaster are very different to Lansing. I mean, one rhymes with glancing, the other is like Burt Lancaster. And I sent an email to Larry Sabato and said, you do realize that your tape is identifying that the Warren Commission is transcribed, had been given duff transcripts. And he wasn't the slightest bit interested. Wasn't the slightest bit interested. And that's when I then dug further in and picked up all the other discrepancies around missing timestamps moved, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I have pretty low regard of Larry Sabato.
Okay, well, you have everything laid out in two parts, the wrong bus transfer, which is at Kennedy's and King now, part one and two, and I will link to that. And thank you very much for your time today, and also thank you for your research and looking into this further for anyone interested.
Great. Super. Thank you.
All right. We'll talk again soon.
Yes. Thanks, Len.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek, and today we're speaking to Ray McGinnis to give us an update on some Canadian news. So, Ray, you just got back from Ottawa, and I'm just so pleased that you've made time to give me a report and people, listeners of Black Op Radio, an update. And so I give you the floor.
Okay. Thanks, Len. Good to be speaking with you again. And yes, I was... After being on an 11-day book tour with my book Unjustified, What the Freedom Convoy, the Emergencies Act, and the Inquiry That Got It Wrong, after being in eight little communities across southwestern Ontario, ended up in Ottawa on the 6th, being interviewed for a forthcoming documentary by Trish Wood, a journalist and podcaster who has a documentary coming out this winter, I think, called The Trials of Tamara Leach. And then there was the court date that I was in Ottawa Courthouse this Tuesday, October 7th. And after the longest mischief trial in Canadian history, the on again, off again, 45 days of the trial plus a day of the verdict on April 3rd, plus 2 days for the sentencing hearings in the 23rd and 24th of July, finally, on the 7th of October, we have the decision. And the decision, it's not as though you just walk into the courtroom after going through the metal scanner and the judge issues a decision and 15 minutes later, it's all over. No, this is like 2.5 hours, like from 10:30 in the morning through till about 10 after 1, she was delivering with a short, like 10-minute break. She was delivering all the reasons, behind her, the decision is explained. And what she read in 2 hours and a half, 2 hours and 40 minutes wasn't even the whole decision. Like she got permission from people in the gallery, about 180, 190 people sort of squeezed into the largest courtroom in the Ottawa courthouse. Plus the defense and the Crown said, yes, go ahead, judge, and read an abridged version of your decision. And so she goes through an awful lot of things that have been said previously in the verdict that she delivered on the 3rd of April. And it's kind of like, it's almost like listening to somebody that you're with you're out for lunch or dinner at a restaurant, and now the waiter or waitress has come and asked this person at the table what they would like to have off the menu. And it's almost as if they're going over, the 18 or 22 different menu items, and almost like they can't decide which one. Well, maybe I'd like to have the hummus. Maybe the pork chops look good. What about the beef stew? What can you tell me about the quesadillas? It's like, and so they're going over and over, and what they're doing in the context of this case is saying, well, the Crown said these things, and it went on, the protest went on for too long, but then again they were entirely peaceful and cooperated with the police and cooperated with the city of Ottawa, and they kind of just keep going back and forth over things that the Crown has touched upon and things that the defense has touched upon. And you're kind of wondering, well, what's she going to finally say? So I took some notes while she was talking. She said things like, politics play no role in the decision of this court. So she's signaling to people that although there may be some concern that this very politically charged court case might have, there might be some people from the Prime Minister's office or somebody playing a little knock on the door or a phone call that might influence her decisions. She's trying to let the general public know that she is free of political interference, I think is what she was saying. So she reviews. The Crown submits the accused were prosecuted for leadership roles and appealed, and the Crown wanted stiff sentences, which were 7 years in jail for Tamara Leach and 8 years for Chris Barber. It's pointed out again that there were victim impact statements that were part of a class action lawsuit. We have a dozen statements from people who are local Ottawa residents or businesses Of those dozens, some of them appeared during the trial, but of those dozen, only three of the victim impact statements said that the people even mentioned Tamara Litch and Chris Barber. None of the victims' impact statements of the people who were inconvenienced ever met either of the co-accused in person. They never had any interactions, any dealings with them, but and as well, the judge pointed out that these victim impact statements are some of whom are anonymous, were made by people who also had their same victim impact statements entered in a civil class action lawsuit against Chris Barber and Tamara Litch and about 20 other named protesters at the protests. So there's a way in which what the judge said was that the defense, she summarized, the defense had said that 8 years is excessive and unfit. Mr. Barber has no criminal record and he has a trucking business. That he cooperated with the police in moving his truck, which is nicknamed Big Red, and attempted to reduce the protest footprint as the as Mr. Barber and Ms. Leach were involved in being a small group of from within the protests that made an effort to meet with key officials in the city of Ottawa, and between the starting on the 14th of February and up until what would have been the evening of the 16th of February 2022, would have had 75% of all the vehicles at the protest leave the city of Ottawa. The remaining 25% would be moved up to Wellington Street and out of any downtown residences entirely. And it's clear demonstrably that they were involved in this effort, and the city of Ottawa staffers took photos of the 102 vehicles that had moved out of the area by noon of the 14th of February 2022. Now, at one point, she says he did mislead police on one occasion, but did not participate in any deliberate misconduct. She also points out that Chris Barber received numerous letters of support. His personal bank account was frozen. $40,000 was spent on attending the on-again, off-again court proceedings. And so she pointed out regarding Tamara Litch that she may have done some things that might have been reckless, she says, but not unlawful. She was not involved in any criminal plan or conspiracy. Her message to the protesters was consistent in an appeal for peace. She's already served 49 days in jail. She lost her job. And she goes on about the defense, saying that the judge noted that only three of the defendants mentioned her. The judge, again, as I'm taking notes, kind of goes back and kind of cycles back and mentions things over and over again. She's kind of being thorough, but she kind of goes into the next paragraph or three, and then you find she's saying what she said again earlier. There was some discussion about the costs to the police, the city of Ottawa police, and the city of Ottawa, maybe, $50 million or $30 million that was spent. But there's the sense that, like, she'll mention this kind of thing, but she's not in her judgment saying, oh, yes, and the government of Canada imposed pandemic measures that resulted in $120 million, 120, sorry, 120,000 small businesses going bankrupt in 2020 alone, and in equal amounts again in 2021 and 2022. So she's choosing certain things to emphasize. Of course, the protests happened in Ottawa, but the reason the protest was happening was because some of the small businesses that had gone bankrupt in 2020 and 2021 were saying, this policy is not working. You're making us go bankrupt. So there's not much of a sense about, I mean, it's kind of brushed over. Yeah, we know you were upset about the pandemic measures, but there's no time that the judge kind of goes into the sort of granular way to say, well, why were these people here? She talks about the financial losses by the Chateau Laurier Hotel and the Lord Elgin, but then after going on about that for quite a while, she says it's hard to link these losses to this case. She points out that the Shepherds of Good Hope and Salvation Army were inconvenienced, and there were concert venues canceled and so on. But again, she finally says, you know, well, it could have been pointed out to the judge that there were all kinds of concerts that were canceled in City of Ottawa venues throughout the pandemic because of the lockdowns. So, in any event, she finally concludes that these inconveniences were not a result of the actions of either of the co-accused. She again talks about how they didn't participate in criminal activity. And she says that the sentencing is to contribute to the rule of law. There must be deterrence of the accused and of others that might be looking to what the accused did and say, I want to do that too. She talked about the broader societal context that must be considered, as well as the charter rights, and the sentence has to be proportionate. She talks about a maximum sentence is only rarely imposed. And so she goes on to say, you know, there are collateral consequences in sentencing, such as the loss of livelihood, you know, that a criminal record will impair Chris Barber's ability to maintain his trucking business. She talked about a number of convoy cases related to this, to the mischief charge. She highlighted the case of Pat King, and the court had found that Pat King had planned ahead of the protest to block downtown streets, that he was advising protesters to stay, that his planning was regarding disruption was premeditated. And that the Crown, you know, eventually he was sentenced to 3 months, considering he'd already served 9 months in jail, you know, and so this sort of gave her a ballpark. She stressed again that neither Leach or Barber were involved in any kind of premeditation. As well, the court did not find obstruction of police or premeditation in the case of Litch and Barber, which you know where Pat King was found guilty of these things. And then she also talked about the case in the Coutts blockade on the Manitoba-Montana border, and she talked at length about that case with Marco Van Hugenbos. And that the length of the mischief charge for Marco Van Hugenbos, who was a key person cooperating with the police, just like Chris Barber and Tamara Leach were also cooperating with the police in Ottawa, that Coutts blockade lasted from January 29th to February 15th. Now, Chris Barber and Tamara Leach only arrived on the 29th, but still she keeps talking about the 28th in Ottawa because there were some people arriving there on the 28th. And Chris Barber and Tamara Leach were arrested on the 17th of February. So basically they were involved in a protest 2 days longer than Marco Van Hugenbos was in Coutts on the Manitoba, on the sorry, the Montana-Alberta border. And so she talks about how in the case of Marco Van Hugenbos, he ended up, I think he had 4 months imprisonment, although I think he ended up only serving 2 months and 2 weeks in total. And then there were a couple of other people as well who, Mr. Jansen and Mr. Van Herk, who were collaborating with Marco Van Hugenbos. Both of them got 90-day conditional sentence, which is basically kind of like house arrest with maybe some curfew around it. And then she talks about the cases of the Coutts II, Chris Carbert and Tony Oleynik, who in relationship, they got several different charges, but in relationship to their charges specific to mischief, they got 6 months incarceration. So then after going through all of this, she also cited another case with somebody who was called Duvet in Quebec, who cut hydro lines and caused the blackouts for 180,000 people. So she goes on with a number of different things. And so what she ends up saying is that it's important not to send a message to the citizens such that would create a chill in people exercising their charter rights of freedom of speech and public assembly. Now I would argue that that all that's gone on with the government's invocation of the Emergencies Act, beating up protesters, freezing bank accounts has already cast quite a chill on the eagerness of the public to protest in the public square. Nonetheless, she goes on to say that what the Crown was asking for was excessive, the 7 and 8 year asks. And so she also says that a conditional sentence, if a person has house arrest, for 12 months and then followed by 6 months for Chris Barber and 3.5 months for Tamara Litch of curfew between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. And considering too that the house arrest for Chris Barber includes his op his he can exercise as long if he goes to work, like drives his truck, including across interprovincial borders on a given assignment, or goes across the U.S. border, he's free to do so. He's free if he goes on such a work trip to stop at a restaurant in Montana, or stop at a restaurant in Manitoba on the way to deliver or pick something up. He's free to shovel snow of his parents. They're both free to go and visit doctors or dentists or go to religious services. They can see, go to a baby's baptism, or go to a memorial service. Go to the class action lawsuit that's going to be happening in Ottawa. So there are a number of things that are provisions, and Chris Barber's. So this was the sentence, which is basically 12 months of house arrest followed by respectively 3.5 months curfew with these 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. for Tamara Litch, and then Chris Barber gets 6 months of the curfew. And Chris Barber's mother said to him on a phone call after the sentence was delivered, "Son, I would far rather you have the 18 months in total of house arrest for 12 months followed by 6 months curfew than have you be in jail for 6 months." And much as prisons have guards there that are supposed to help keep inmates peaceful and nonviolent toward each other, but you never know. if you end up in a cell and your cellmate's name is Mongo and they're in there for second degree murder, and they have a kind of a 3 second switch going from peaceful to blowing their stack, you don't want to have a cellmate like that. So I think that Chris Barber's mother is wise to say that she, you know, they, I mean, of course, one thing I'm going to add to this, there's a guy who was given a conditional sentence at home. And he, guy's name, his surname is like Akbari, and this is out of what he was doing. He was sentenced this summer, to 2 months conditional sentence, so how 2 months of house arrest. His crime was he was plotting or talking about bombing all of the synagogues in Toronto and killing as many Jews as possible. So there's a 2 month conditional sentence with house arrest for somebody who was plotting actual violence, compared to two people who, Tamara Litch and Chris Barber, who under the impression that you can publicly protest because of your charter rights of freedom of assembly and freedom of speech, who were peaceful all the way through. And they end up with, 15 and a half and 18 months, respectively. So the Canadian justice system, it's like you flip a coin and find out, week to week what's really going on.
Okay, well, I have a couple of questions then, because man, it's taxing just listening to your quick summation. It was 2.5 hours she did this, flipping back and forth. What was it for TV or something?
No, this is
no, I'm being facetious, trying to like a judge.
No, she's well, I mean, there are a number of journalists that are in the courtroom, and they're I mean, I didn't happen to bring my computer that morning because I had been there were two vehicles that were people who, I guess I would say, trusted people who were either immediate family or people that were part of the protest in Ottawa, or someone like me who's written a book that they're glad for what I did. So we went off in two vehicles, and I happened to just not think to bring my computer or tweet things as opposed to take notes. But in any event, it's a lot, it's a lot to listen to. Yeah,
Yeah, well, that's
so.
what I'm getting to. So my first question is, do you have any idea how much this cost the Canadian
Okay,
taxpayers?
I think so. My understanding is that, and this it probably is an old figure now, but I think sometime in August, and I'll find it for you with your show notes, there was some sort of a figure reported this summer that the Canadian government has spent at least $21 million, and that's before this one day trial. And there's been quite a few trials that have happened in the month of September since this was reported, but $21 million as of this summer have been spent on various different Freedom Convoy prosecutions. I think that the figure for this specific case, the ta Canadian taxpayers paid about $2 to $2.5 million on this case alone.
Did she have anything much to say about the freezing of bank accounts? I mean, that is just unreal to me that the trial's not over, the guy's not found guilty or anything, but oh, we're freezing your account.
Yes. Well, what this is where it's interesting. Like, there'll be a long discussion about the victim impact statements, even though they're finally kind of seen as they're a factor, but not so much, because none of the victims in question ever had any interaction with the accused. However, then there's a mention of, well, one of the mitigating factors in making the sentence longer is that Mr. Barber had his bank accounts frozen, your personal bank account frozen for 3 or 4 weeks. But that's it. Like, it's like about a sentence or two, and then on she goes to something else, which I would think she needs it would be I would prefer that she spend a good amount of time reflecting on that, but she doesn't.
Yeah, how is that even legal?
Well, it's only
It isn't.
It is technically, I suppose you could say, it's technically legal that they did it because they invoked the Emergencies Act, which made it possible for the government to then pass any legislation without even going before Parliament, just because we've declared it's an emergency. Now, the other shoe that drops around that whole discussion is that 1 year later, on the 23rd of February, sorry, of January of 2023, a federal court, Justice Mosley, ruled that the government acted illegally and unconstitutionally, and that the freezing of bank accounts was entirely ad hoc. Everything about that was suspect and prejudicial,
Right, but
and
that was different. That was to for people donating money. Now,
Oh,
what, right?
well, no, not, not well,
Like there
it
was a
was.
GoFundMe that got shut down. There was they were trying to make it hard for people to support the cause. But I was just implying here that they shut his bank account down. Not only, forget about it, people donating.
Yeah, well, I'm not talking about the people donated. They were about nearly 300 people had their bank accounts frozen who were protesting in Ottawa or who, by happenstance, were somehow related to the people protesting in Ottawa. And the police thought, oh, well, let's go after so and so's ex-wife who doesn't even live in Ottawa, who's not even at the protest. Like they were doing that kind of stuff in addition to.
Oh.
To warning people about donating.
Yeah. Well, that's disturbing. Okay, so that it's a long drawn out 2.5 hours of boredom, like a bad movie, to finally say, look, I've looked over everything. I've decided what they did is not criminal. And so but the cause of mischief is so light and vague. I mean, like you could have kicked over neighbors' garbage cans and been charged with mischief, right?
Yes, although with this particular mischief charge, they will have criminal records. And it's very troubling because the mischief charge, which I want to add that the now there are two co-accused, Tamara Litch and Chris Barber. I think that both of them are weighing their options about whether they will appeal not the sentence but the conviction of mischief, because what the judge did in her April 3rd verdict was to say that, well, yes, you have the right to freedom of assembly and freedom of speech and to protest in the public square. And if you're going to protest in the public square, you're going to protest someplace physically, which will be a public road or a public park or in front of Parliament Hill or whatever. And the judge said that property rights. And public property rights, because it wasn't as though the protesters were protesting on the in the properties of people's residences or inside somebody's commercial store. They were protesting on commercial roads and laneways and on Parliament Hill and some other parks. So what the judge is saying that the right to enjoyment of public space, public property, supersedes the right to protest freedom of assembly and free speech. And so it's like she's and this is why I think that there may well be an appeal about the sentences of mischief, because if this stands, then it really means that in the future, when Canadian citizens try to protest some public policy of any government, federal or provincial, there may be some citizens in their own community that don't like what they're protesting about and say, I don't like you being in that parquet. I don't like you being on that street or boulevard. And then off you go again with people being charged with mischief. And whither goes freedom of assembly?
Well, I'll be watching with interest. So this is great that you went there. I'm speaking to somebody who actually walks the walk as a reporter. You're there. You're on your book tour, and yeah, that's great. I mean, I can't trust anything on CBC or CTV.
Yeah, you never, you never know. And I say like there's other things that I can't know, behind the scenes, what happens. I mean, Chris Barber got this extra charge of not obeying a court injunction to stop honking of horns. But it's a, that particular charge that he was charged with. I mean, there's no evidence that he actually honked a horn after the injunction to stop honking horns. And in fact, there was at least one occasion where he was speaking to some other people on some sort of a social media platform who were suggesting on the 17th of February, the day before the big crackdown, that they might maybe should start honking horns. And he was saying, no, we shouldn't do that because we'll be, in contravention of the horn honking injunction. So that particular instance wasn't brought up. And I think There probably are other examples where he was wanting, advising people to abide by the injunction. So I can't second guess why a lawyer doesn't bring all their trump cards before a judge. But anyway, it
Right.
is what it is.
It might be a bit, maybe they're just relieved that it turned out probably for the best. It didn't kick off another revolution and another whole trucker protest.
Yeah.
But so the other bit of news was you said that after the verdict was read and they went out the court, you got to meet them for a coffee or something. And can you tell us their spirits and just in a nutshell what?
Yeah, I was staying at the same hotel and or an adjacent hotel owned by the same hotel owners, and there's a common patio area, and I was able to visit a little bit with both of them, and I think that they are relieved, and that they, as much as their defense teams wanted the judge to grant them a complete discharge, they are relieved that the sentences they've been given are what I would call workable. I mean, Chris Barber is able to carry on working as a truck driver. I mean, the most restrictive aspect of it will be that every time he has a day off, he sort of pretty well has to sit at home unless he schedules all his dental, chiropractic, doctor appointments on his days
Okay,
off.
but fair, but they were they're at least happy about that. Their legal team that, having this conditional curfew, it seems like I just couldn't believe if they were going to be sentenced for 7 years. I just unbelievable, really. And the fact that it was even brought like that, you think, what the hell's going on? Like, are you kidding me?
Well, it makes for sensational headlines, as it did when the Crown, after the verdict, then the Crown said we want 7 and 8 years. So it was sort of since April 3rd that suddenly this big request for an excessive punishment
Yeah,
became
punitive.
a big, which I'm sure played to a certain part of the government's base that has almost gets deranged the moment they hear the names of the accused. There's also the Crown has also, in a separate motion, there will be a trial this November, because the Crown wants to be able to seize Chris Barber's truck, which is his a vehicle, which these big trucks cost a lot of money. I don't know what they price them at, $500,000 or more, and they want to seize the truck and destroy it because it's a symbol of the convoy, although it was not the only truck there. So,
Oh my God, right?
I think of the Crown in Canada in relation to these convoy cases. They're very much like Inspector Javert in Victor Hugo's musical and novel, Les Miserables, who's pursuing Jean Valjean for decades. So they, and I can tell you that when the first, well, when, after both of the sentences were delivered, and there was clapping in the gallery of nearly 200 people, the Crown were visibly frowning and looking angry as they walked out of the room. It would not surprise me that the Crown will, and the Crown has 30 days to appeal the sentences, and the Crown,
And spend more millions on this,
yeah,
right?
the Crown has a long history with all of these convoy cases of, there'll be a sentence delivered or verdict delivered, and the Crown will wait. They have 30 days to appeal, and they'll wait till the 30th day, the last hour, and then they will appeal. And then off again go the accused, having to again raise more money to fight the government in court.
And they don't really see that they're the problem. The problem. I mean, if the prime minister or you had come out to meet with them on a day two or three and say, "Listen, here's what I can do. Here's what I can't do. Can we? Is there any compromise?" But he refused to meet with them and just let them eat cake. So, A lot of people stayed there. I watched with enthusiasm, like the bouncy castles and the family surroundings of it, and all the people were there. They brought their children, saying, "We want them to see us fight government peacefully." And then the headlines were, "They're using their children as shields." You know, sickening, right?
Yes, there were 10 bouncy castles, in fact. So, there was a big play area for children, and they had people with little bubbles, blowing bubbles,
And you had mentioned that the RCMP there had, or the city police had reported this was like the most nonviolent protest they had ever, you know, there's no violence. There's no, they're objecting, and once they stopped honking the horns, then contrary to what you saw in the press, like, oh, any day they're going to blow it up, right?
Yes, well, and I have discussed with enough people with the horn honking injunction on the 7th of February. So by that afternoon, people who arrived that day, who thought, oh, I'm going to arrive and there's going to be all this horn honking, they were surprised there was no honking at all. Now, the real exception to any violation of that injunction is that all the people who were protesting in Ottawa didn't all arrive on the 29th of January, or a few of them on the 28th. People kept coming throughout the whole length of the protest. So if somebody suddenly decided to leave Quebec City on the 9th of February, or leave Sarnia, Ontario, or Windsor, Ontario on the 10th of February, or leave Winnipeg, or Kingston, Ontario on the 12th, and they arrived, they might honk their horns a couple times as they arrive, and then once they got put into place by, as police instructed them to park in a certain place, they would be told by the block captain of the convoy, "We have an injunction. You're not allowed to honk. If you honk your horn, we'll cut your air horn." So, I can understand why a couple of people would have rolled in and they wouldn't have gotten the memo regarding the injunction, and then they stop honking. But there was nothing like the constant blare of horns the first numbers of days. And I want to add too that the honking, by the 3rd of February, if not the 2nd, ended by 6 p.m. Each night, although I think there was a lot of mayhem and honking into the night the first, four days or so. Yeah, it's there's a lot of misconstruing. It would not surprise me that some of the mainstream media, CBC, Global, and CTV, may have chosen to get some old footage of honking of horns, like on the 13th of February, that was from back, like on the 4th of February, and play that in the background to make people think that the horn honking was still going on in a massive way, which it wasn't.
Okay, so we've covered that then. Thank you so much for going there and taking time today for that. Now, there's a couple of other little things you mentioned you want to talk about.
Yes, there are. Considering you mentioned about people and our rights and everything, there are a number of bills before the Canadian Parliament right now, which have to do with civil liberties and freedoms of expression. There is something called the Strong Border Act, which is Bill C-2, and it will empower Canada Post to open letter mail without a warrant. It will criminalize transfers of cash in amounts of $10,000 or higher. It will also empower not only police, but numerous government officials to conduct warrantless searches of computers and cell phones. And so you have to wonder what, it's all in the name of national security, and that there are state actors from other foreign nations that are trying to do things to hobble Canada. But at the very same time as you have this kind of act that's being, tabled and I mean brought forward in Parliament, to without warrants to open anybody's letters in the mail, you also have a government that's extremely reluctant to say anything about investigating say, the government of China's plausible interference in recent Canadian elections, even having Chinese police being, you know, setting up their own little police stations or infiltrating police stations and precincts. So it's very troubling that you would have this kind of almost Stasi kind of legislation. As I recall, East Germany, if anyone's ever seen The Lives of Others, a film from, I think, the 2000s that talks about the kind of way in which people are being surveilled. So we have that one. We also have Bill C-9, which is called the Combating Hate Act, where prosecution will be based not on what citizens have done, but what they have said and written. So, you know, said on a podcast or written in a letter to the editor or written on social media or even written in a private letter between each other based on Canada Post's permission to open letter mail without warrants. And so this new legislation is also saying that any decision to initiate hate speech prosecution will no longer need to be reviewed by the Attorney General of the province in question. And judges are also going to be encouraged to impose much longer sentences for hate speech. As well, concerningly, the legislation in Bill C-9 does not define hate. It's very subjective. And so there's going to be a lot of room for police and the Crown to proceed with a case with a vague definition of hate. We also have, you know, somewhere in the mix, the Online Harms Act, which sort of died under the Trudeau government, is something else that will very likely emerge again before the Parliament, where people can be fined $50,000 for on the suspicion that they are going to do something hateful. And so if somebody else believes that someone that they know, who's maybe a neighbor or maybe an ex-boyfriend or girlfriend or, you know, a boss that they don't like, that they believe that this person that they've named may commit in the future a crime, then they can snitch on them. And the person who's accused, when they have to go before the police or before a judge, that won't know who their accusers are, which really flips one of the long-standing frameworks of Western legal system with the Magna Carta, where you are charged with something and then you have a right to face your accusers. With this kind of legislation in Canada, people won't know who's accused them of a future crime what they're being charged for preemptively. And then the final thing in the mix is Bill C-8, which is a cybersecurity act, and cabinet ministers will have the power to kick citizens off the internet. They'll be able to acquire subscriber information from any online company. They can apply administrative penalties to any citizen that they think has fallen into the sphere of what the Cybersecurity Act is supposed to stop. And so people can be charged $50,000 a day. And if you're a corporation, you can be charged $1.5 million a day. Now, the thing in all the mix of this is that hacking, for example, is already a criminal offense and well spelled out, so that there are, you know, in the name of security of the nation, you can bring these various bills forward. But much of what the government is saying that it wants to stop, hate speech specifically, there's already lots of legislation in the criminal code to stop the things that they're saying, but then you have these extra added things that are going to be very problematic, and I think will also, as the crackdown on the Freedom Convoy in February of 22, I think that these bills are also going to put a chill on people's speech. They're going to watch what they say. in case they're going to watch what they say and watch what they write, in case they end up in the crosshairs of aggressive prosecutions by people who like wielding power.
Wow. Makes me want to stop using banks. I wonder if you have everything in Bitcoin, if that would help.
Well, maybe Len, at the end of each of your podcasts, you could end with a very flattering 1 or 2 minutes about how much you appreciate our sitting prime minister, perhaps, and that will mitigate any possible adverse impact on your show. Just kidding.
It's not possible. And it's such a weird thing that the great line by the Who, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. If you thought Justin was bad, look at the new guy. Well, yeah.
So there we have that, and then we have the situation with the Universal Ostrich Farm in rural British Columbia, a 7-hour drive northeast of Vancouver, which I've been fortunate to be able to travel there twice in late May and mid-July. There's a doctor named PhD Dr. Stephen Pellock out of the University of British Columbia, who's been involved with the ostrich farm and looking at the antibodies of the ostriches, that I mean, you have this flock of 400 ostriches. Two died back in late December, it seems, of the avian flu. And there were more than 400, but 400 left. There were another, a number of birds, some dozens of birds died, but those were ones that were kind of really green. The existing birds were the ones that have been around for some dozens of years, who have more resilience, and so they know that this flock has immunity to the avian bird flu. And so, wouldn't you want, in the efforts of research and scientific, possibly medical benefit, to see what the antibodies of the ostriches are in their ostrich eggs, and use that as to perhaps create a spray, like a nasal spray, that helps stop any human being that might get the avian flu in its tracks. And I want to add that we've only had one person in Canada since, in 2014, somebody came from China, and they already had the avian bird flu, and then they died in Canada. And the standards of cleanliness and everything in terms of poultry farms and in China is not up to the same standard that we have in Canada. But in any event, human to human transmission of avian bird flu is almost unheard of, I think. So there's all of this
Well, I'm going to
concern.
underscore this. I know you know this, but the fact that they said, we do not want you to test these birds, by the way, and we're going to give you a $200,000 fine for each bird you test and or 6 months in jail. So don't test the birds, and then the fix is in. It's pathetic, right? And then you find out, Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister, is investing with $50 million into, I think, Moderna, whatever, looking for an avian flu shot. So they want their, payoff, their kickbacks to come in, right? They don't want them to investigate, like with these eggs. And that's what, some of these birds are 30 years old. These guys have been doing this. I don't think they sell ostrich meat,
No, they did prior to the pandemic, but they have been they have an there's an ostrich oil that they sell. There's also some things that they do with the leather, or whatever. I'm not sure if it's called leather of the ostrich, but they do some things, some products, but it's not for food. So as well, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency requires the farmers, the mother and father and the daughter, or the, well, the no, the, there's the mother and the daughter, and then there's another man who's from another family, and so the three farmers together go into the ostrich pens multiple times a day, and to feed the birds, to take care of them, to check in on the 400 birds, make sure that they have what they have to feed them, and make sure they have enough, that they're hydrated and so on. So when they go in with their vehicle, it's like having like a total shampoo for the car. Like they have to do practically wiping it down with handy wipes or whatever else to make sure that the vehicle is sterile and not a problem going into the ostrich pens. But now the Canadian Food Inspection Agency staff are there. So when they have the Canadian Food Inspection vehicles, the agency vehicles, or the RCMP vehicles. Now we've got about 100 RCMP officers all dealing with this. I mean, there are a lot of things going on in terms of real crime, but no, we've got 100 officers all focused on this. When an RCMP vehicle or a Canadian Food Inspection Agency vehicle goes into the ostrich pens, they don't do any kind of shampoo, sterilization, anything like that. They don't even wash the windshields. They just roll right into the ostrich pen as if their vehicles could never, need to be sanitized, whereas the farmers have to do it every time, throughout the day if they go in there. And of course, now the farmers are not even allowed to go in there. So it's
Oh yeah, they put up this big kill pen, bales of hay, so you can't see all what's going on in there. And then they disconnected all the families' security cameras, and then they had drones up, so they put a no-fly zone. You're not allowed to see what's going on there. I mean, it's really an authoritarian state takeover, right? And the fact that you just can't test the birds, that I can't underscore that enough. I mean, that just tells you they don't want to know that there is a cure for avian flu. The birds have got this natural immunity and they're not sick anymore. The few that were sick and died, that was a year ago or whatever, right? So now,
last December, yeah.
just sickening.
Yeah. So they also have there was one of the hens, as they're called, when the RCMP had low flying drones just sort of over the over just above the heads of the ostriches. The drones scared numbers of the ostriches, and one hen in particular, to get out of the way of the drone, ran into a fence and broke its leg. So then it was in it, they were not allowing the farmers to go in, not allowing a vet to go in and look at the ostrich. They were saying the Food Inspection Agency staff were saying, "Oh, it's okay, we're taking care of it." But it was clear that they were not providing the injured ostrich with any water, so it was completely dehydrated. And then they agreed to give the ostrich the electrolytes that the farmers said that the ostrich needed to recover. And then someone was able, with I guess a long range camera or whatever else, to see the Food Inspection Agency staffers go off with that little bag of electrolytes and then dump it behind some bushes. So they never
Yeah,
the
and then
ostriches,
the ostrich died.
yeah, the ostrich died. And before the ostrich died, I think Global TV was reporting, oh, not that there's an ostrich that because a drone was hovering around and scaring it, went off and banged into a fence and broke its leg. Global TV was saying, "Oh, it looks like there's a sick bird here." So again, misleading the viewership who
Yeah,
are.
even further, I think they said something, it died of a previous injury. What the hell was it? Previous. Anyway, yeah.
So the ostrich in question that's recently died, called Spirit, did not die
Avian flu.
well, it didn't die from avian flu. It died because it
No,
was.
yeah, I know that. I think another one has a broken toe from running into the fence too.
It's so it's yeah so it's just it just seems like there's it may even we may even hear tomorrow when you broadcast this, if the Supreme Court is willing to hear the case go before it. But the Supreme Court has been very avoidant of hearing any cases regarding either the convoy or this kind of a case. They seem to defer to public health, or in this case, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, as the high priests of an errant and infallible wisdom that cannot be questioned.
Well, really disgusting. Okay, well, I'll provide links, and I'll make links to, but for the show notes, whatever you have to offer.
We used to be we'd sing "O Canada" with a single O in the alphabet, and then Canada. I think more and more it's like "OH, O Canada." We gotta steer the ship around.
You get the sense of a totalitarian state working its way in everywhere around the world. All these other countries are people are looking up, and I hope they take George Orwell to heart.
Well, I think totalitarian. I think another phrase has been used, like the managerial state. It's as though we have in Canada now def have a culture, well, an establishment political class that whose view is that the people who are in positions to manage the unelected bureaucrats from different agencies, as well as the politicians in government, when they make a decision, that decision cannot be questioned, and that the role then of the judiciary is simply to double down on whatever decisions have been made by state actors, bureaucrats or politicians, so that the state never has any reason to apologize.
It's well, I don't want to get too despondent about the whole thing, but it's not optimistic.
No. So, but I think that this is why it's important. I'm so glad to be on your show, because unless we have these conversations and people can think about these things, then it can all be unfolding without people knowing. People get have busy lives and get distracted, and these things can be going on all around you and you're not noticing.
Okay, so you mentioned that you were on your book tour. Do you want to promote that and plug that right now?
Oh,
So, in
sure.
case anybody didn't know about it, where can they find it? What's it about?
Yeah, so my book called Unjustified, The Freedom Convoy, The Emergencies Act, and The Inquiry That Got It Wrong is a book about the Freedom Convoy protests in Ottawa in 2022, in January, February 2022. About the government's decision to invoke the Emergencies Act and freeze bank accounts, about the required, every time a government in Canada invokes the Emergencies Act, as happened for the first time in 2022, when a government does that, there must be a public inquiry to determine if the government was justified or not. And so I had flown to that inquiry in Ottawa and sat through a week of the public hearings and heard 14 witnesses and read through all 76 of the transcripts of the different witnesses and read through the report. And then I read through the following year the 200-page decision by the federal court that decided the government acted legally. And I've also been to the court proceedings at times for some of the trial of the Coots too on on the Montana-Alberta border, and also at various iterations of the trial of Tamara Litch and Chris Barber in Ottawa. And so my book is about this. It also includes some chapters about the science, which was what the judge said. We're going to talk about the conduct of the protesters, but we're not going to talk about why they came here. So I talk a bit about the science and the safe and effective public messaging, as well as democracy. So it's a book for to chronicle these times, what's happening in Canada as a case study for those to learn about, and hopefully in the years to come, we'll have some more wisdom about what to do when governments go in these directions. So my book can be available online in Barnes and Noble, Kobo, Amazon. It's available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. You can also order it at your favorite physical bookstore if you like.
Okay, do you have a website?
I'm just on X. I have
Okay, well, send me any link you have and I'll
I'll
post
send you the
that.
links for X. And unanswered questions.ca, which is mostly about my prior book on the September 11th Family Steering Committee effort for a transparent investigation into that public inquiry in America.
Yeah, I was glad to see Tucker Carlson did, I think, 5 episodes on 9/11, and they're very interesting. And I was even surprised to see that I think Google and YouTube had admitted, I think last week or so, that they were pressuring people that were complaining about COVID and then deleting accounts. And now they've decided they will reinstate those accounts where people were saying, you know, there's something wrong here. And if you complain too much, they just deleted your account. And I don't know if anybody's going to take them up on that, but they said they would reinstate a lot of accounts. And that was surprising to me.
Well, let's hope so.
Okay, Ray, thank you so much for taking time. I know short notice, you just got back from Ottawa this morning, but I appreciate it. I really do.
Great. Good to speak to you as always, Len.
All right, thank you.